Chapter 3. First Impressions. Those first few weeks, and indeed all the early part of my imprisonment, made a deep impression on my imagination. The following years, on the other hand, are all mixed up together, and leave but a confused recollection. Whole periods, in fact, have been effaced from my memory. Generally speaking, however, I remember the life as the same, always painful, monotonous, and stifling. What I experienced during the first days of my imprisonment seems to me as if it took place but yesterday, nor is that unnatural. I remember so well in the first place my surprise that prison routine afforded no outstanding feature, nothing extraordinary, or perhaps I should say unexpected. It was only when I had been there for some time that I took notice of all that was strange and unimagined. The discovery was astonishing. I confess that this sense of wonder never left me during the remainder of my time, and I never became fully acclimatized to my surroundings. First of all, I experienced an invincible repugnance on arriving, but oddly enough, the life seemed to me less painful than I had imagined on the journey. Indeed, prisoners, though encumbered by their irons, moved about quite freely. They abused one another, sang, worked, smoked their pipes, and drank spirits, but there were not many drinkers. There were also regular card parties during the night. The labour did not seem to me particularly arduous. I fancied, indeed, that it could not be the real hard labour. I did not understand till long afterwards what in fact made it hard and even excessive. It was less by reason of its difficulty than because it was forced, imposed, obligatory, and because it was done only through fear of the stick. The peasant certainly works harder than the convict, for during the summer he works night and day, but it is in his own interest that he fatigues himself. His aim is reasonable, so that he suffers less than the convict, who performs hard labour from which he derives no profit. It once occurred to me that if one desired to reduce a man to nothing, to punish him atrociously, to crush him in such a manner that the most hardened murderer would tremble before such a punishment and take fright beforehand, one need only render his work completely useless, even to the point of absurdity. Hard labour, as it is now organized, affords the convict no interest, but it has its utility. The convict makes bricks, digs the earth, builds, and all his occupations have a meaning and an end. Sometimes the prisoner may even take an interest in what he is doing. He then wishes to work more skilfully, more advantageously. But let him be constrained to pour water from one vessel into another, or to transport a quantity of earth from one place to another, in order to perform the contrary operation immediately afterwards, then I am persuaded that at the end of a few days he would strangle himself or commit 1,000 capital offences rather than live in so abject a condition and endure such torment. It is evident that such punishment would be torture, atrocious, vengeance rather than correction. It would be absurd, for it would have no natural end. I did not, however, arrive until the winter, in the month of December, and the labour was then unimportant in our fortress. I had no idea of the summer labour 5 times as fatiguing. During the winter season we worked on the Irtych, breaking up old boats belonging to the government, found occupation in the workshops, cleared the buildings from snowdrifts, or burned and pounded alabaster. As the days were very short, work ended early, and everyone returned to the prison, where there was scarcely anything to do except the supplementary work which the convicts did for themselves. Scarcely a third of the convicts worked seriously. The others idled their time and wandered about without an aim in the barracks, scheming and insulting one another. Those who had a little money got drunk on spirits, or lost what they had saved at gambling, and all this from idleness, weariness, and want of something to do. I experienced, moreover, one form of suffering which is perhaps the sharpest, the most painful that can be experienced in a house of detention cut off from law and liberty. I mean forced association. Association with one's fellow men is to some extent forced everywhere and always, but nowhere is it so horrible as in a prison, where there are men with whom no one would consent to live. I am certain that every convict, unconsciously perhaps, has suffered from this. Our food seemed to me not too bad. Some even declared that it was incomparably better than in any Russian prison. I cannot confirm this, for I was never in prison anywhere else. Many of us besides were allowed to procure whatever nourishment we wished. Those who always had money allowed themselves the luxury of eating fresh meat, which cost only 3 kopecks a pound. But the majority of the prisoners were contented with the regular ration. Those who praised the diet were thinking chiefly of the bread, which was distributed at the rate of so much per room, and not individually or by weight. This latter system would have been terribly severe, for a third of the men at least would have been constantly hungry. But under the existing regulation, everyone was satisfied. Our bread was particularly good, and was even renowned in the town. Its quality was attributed to the excellent construction of the prison ovens. As for our cabbage soup, it was cooked and thickened with flour, and had not an appetizing appearance. On working days it was clear and thin, but what particularly disgusted me was the way it was served. The other prisoners, however, paid no attention to that. During the 3 days following my arrival, I did not go to work. Some respite was always given to convicts just arrived, in order to allow them to recover from their fatigue. On the second day, I had to go outside the prison in order to be ironed. My chain was not of the regulation pattern. It was composed of rings which gave forth a clear sound, so I heard other convicts say. I had to wear them externally over my clothes, whereas my companions had chains formed not of rings, but of 4 links, as thick as the finger, and fastened together by 3 links which were worn beneath the trousers. To the central ring was fastened a strip of leather, tied in its turn to a girdle fastened over the shirt. I can see again my first morning in prison. A drum beat in the orderly room near the principal entrance. 10 minutes later, the under-officer opened the barracks. The convicts woke up one after another and rose trembling with cold from their plank bedsteads by the dim light of a tallow candle. Nearly all of them were morose. They yawned and stretched themselves. Their foreheads, marked by the iron, were contracted. Some made the sign of the cross. Others began to talk nonsense. The cold air from outside rushed in as soon as the door was opened. Then the prisoners hurried round the pails full of water, and one after another took a mouthful of water, spat it out into their hands, and washed their faces. Those pails had been brought in on the previous night by a prisoner specially appointed, according to the rules, to clean the barrack. The convicts chose them themselves. He did not work with the others, for it was his business to examine the camp bedsteads and floors, and also to fetch and carry the water used in the morning for the prisoners' ablutions and during the rest of the day for drinking. That very morning there were disputes on the subject of one of the pitchers. "What are you doing there with your branded forehead?" grumbled one of the prisoners, tall, dry, and sallow. He was remarkable for the strange protuberances which covered his skull, and now he pushed against another convict, round and small, with a lively, rubicund face. "Just wait. What are you talking about? You know there's a fine to be paid when others are kept waiting. Get out of the way. What a monument, my brethren." "A little calf," he went on muttering. "See, the white bread of the prison has fattened him. What do you take yourself for? A fine bird indeed." "You're about right. What kind of bird?" "You needn't ask. How so? Find out." They devoured one another with their eyes. The little man, waiting for a reply with clenched fists, was apparently ready to fight. I thought they would come to blows. It was all quite new to me, and I watched the scene with curiosity. Later on I learned that such quarrels were perfectly harmless, that they served for entertainment, like an amusing comedy. Such episodes scarcely ever ended in violence, and this fact taught me a great deal about the character of my fellow prisoners. The tall fellow remained calm and majestic. He felt that some answer was expected from him if he was not to be dishonoured and covered with ridicule. He had to show that he was a wonderful bird, a personage. Accordingly, he cast a sidelong glance at his adversary, endeavouring with inexpressible contempt to irritate him by looking at him over his shoulder, up and down as he would have done an insect. At last, the little fat man was so irritated that he would have thrown himself upon his antagonist had not his companions surrounded the combatants to prevent a serious quarrel.
"Fight with your fists, not with your tongues," cried a spectator from the corner of the room. "No, hold them," answered another. "They are going to fight. We are fine fellows. One against seven is our style." Fine fighting men. One was here for having sneaked a pound of bread. The other was a pot stealer. He was whipped by the executioner for stealing a pot of curdled milk from an old woman.
"Enough! Keep quiet!" cried a retired soldier, whose business it was to keep order in the barrack, and who slept in a corner of the room on a bedstead of his own.
"Water, my children! Water for Nevalid Petrovich! Water for our little brother who has just woken up!"
"Your brother? Am I your brother? Did we ever drink a ruble's worth of spirits together?" muttered the old soldier, as he passed his arms through the sleeves of his greatcoat. The roll was about to be called, for it was already late. The prisoners were hurrying towards the kitchen. They had to put on their pelisses, and then go to receive in their parti-coloured caps the bread which one of the cooks, one of the bakers, that is to say, was distributing. These cooks, like the men who did the household work, were chosen by the prisoners themselves. There were two for the kitchen, making four servants in all for the prison. They had at their disposal the only kitchen knife authorised in the prison, which was used for cutting up the bread and meat. The prisoners arranged themselves in groups around the tables as best they could in caps and pelisses, with leather girdles round their waists, all ready to begin work. Some of the convicts had kvass before them, in which they steeped pieces of bread. The noise was insupportable. Many of the convicts, however, were talking together in corners, with a steady, tranquil air.
"Good morning and good appetite, Antonich," said a young prisoner, sitting down by the side of an old man who had lost his teeth.
"If you are not joking, well, good morning," said the latter, without raising his eyes, and endeavouring to masticate a piece of bread with his toothless gums.
"I declare I fancied you were dead, Antonich."
"You die first, I'll follow you."
I sat down beside them. On my right, two convicts were conversing with an attempt at dignity.
"I'm not likely to be robbed," said one of them. "I'm more afraid of stealing myself."
"It wouldn't be a good idea to rob me. The devil, I'd pay the man out."
"But what would you do? You're only a convict. We have no other name."
"You see, she'll rob you, the wretch, without even saying thank you. The money I gave her was wasted. Just fancy. She was here a few days ago. Where were we to go? Shall I ask permission to go into the house of Theodore, the executioner? He has still his house in the suburb, the one he bought from that Solomon, you know, that scurvy Jew who hanged himself not long ago. Yes, I know him. The one who sold liquor here 3 years ago, and who is called Grichka, the secret drinking shop. I know. All brag. You don't know. In the first place, it's another's drinking shop."
"What do you mean, another? You don't know what you're talking about. I'll bring you as many witnesses as you like."
"Oh, you will you? Who are you? Do you know to whom you were speaking?"
"Yes, indeed. I've thrashed you often enough, though I don't boast of it."
"Don't give yourself airs, then."
"You've thrashed me? The man who'll thrash me has yet to be born, and the man who did is 6 feet below ground."
plague-stricken rascal of Bender. May the Siberian leprosy devour you with ulcers. May a chopper cleave your dog of a head.
Insults were falling like rain.
Come now, they're going to fight. When men can't behave properly, they should keep quiet. They're only too glad to come and eat government bread, the rascals.
They were soon separated. They fight with their tongues as much as they wish. That is allowed. It is a diversion at everyone's disposal. But no blows. It was indeed only in extraordinary cases that blows were exchanged. If there was a fight, it was reported to the governor, who ordered an inquiry or directed one himself, and then woe to the culprits. Accordingly, the prisoners set their faces against anything like a serious quarrel. Besides, they insulted one another chiefly to pass the time, as an oratorical exercise. They get excited. The quarrel takes on a furious, ferocious character. They seem about to slaughter one another, but nothing of the kind happens. As soon as their anger has reached a certain pitch, they separate. That astonished me much, and if I can relate certain conversations between the convicts, I do so with a purpose. Could I have imagined that people could have insulted one another for pleasure, that they could find enjoyment in it? We must not forget the gratification of vanity. A dialectician who knows how to insult artistically is respected. A little more, and he would be applauded like an actor. Already on the previous night, I had noticed some glances in my direction, and several convicts had even hung around me, as if they suspected that I had brought money with me. They endeavoured to get into my good graces by teaching me how to carry my irons without inconvenience, and gave me, of course, in return for money, a box with a lock, in which to keep the equipment entrusted to me by the authorities, and the few shirts that I had been allowed to bring with me. Yet the very next morning those same prisoners stole my box, and drank the money which they had taken out of it. One of them afterwards became a great friend of mine, though he robbed me whenever opportunity offered. He was all the same vexed at what he had done. He committed these thefts almost unconsciously, as if in the way of a duty. Consequently, I bore him no grudge. These convicts let me know that one could have tea, and that I should do well to get myself a teapot. They found me one, which I hired for a certain time. They also recommended me a cook, who, for 30 kopecks a month, would arrange the dishes I might desire, if it was my intention to buy provisions and take my meals apart. Of course, they borrowed money from me. The day of my arrival, I was asked for a loan on 3 separate occasions. We noblemen who had been degraded and incarcerated here were frowned upon by our fellow prisoners. Although we had lost all our rights, like the other convicts, we were not regarded as comrades. In this instinctive repugnance there was an element of reason. To them we were always gentlemen, although they often jeered at our fall. "Ah, it's all over now. Monsieur's carriage formerly crushed the passers-by at Moscow. Now Monsieur picks hemp." They knew our sufferings, though we hid them as much as possible. It was principally when we were all working together that we had most to endure, for our strength was not so great as theirs, and we were really not of much assistance to them. Nothing is more difficult than to gain the confidence of the common people, especially such people as these. There were only a few of us in the whole prison who were of noble birth. First, there were 5 Poles, of whom I shall later speak in detail. They were detested by the convicts more, perhaps, than the Russian nobles. The Poles, I speak only of the political convicts, always behaved to them with a constrained and offensive politeness, scarcely ever speaking to them, and making no endeavour to conceal the disgust which they experienced in such company. The convicts understood all this, and paid them back in their own coin. 2 years passed before I could gain the goodwill of my companions, but the greater part of them liked me, and declared that I was a good fellow. There were altogether, counting myself, 5 Russian nobles in the convict prison. I had heard of one of them, even before my arrival, as a vile and base creature, horribly corrupt, doing the work of spy and informer. Accordingly, from the very first day, I refused to enter into relations with this man. The second was the parricide, to whom I have already referred. The third was Akimich. I have seldom met such an extraordinary man, and I still have a lively recollection of him. Tall, thin, weak-minded, and terribly ignorant, he was as argumentative and meticulous as a German. The convicts laughed at him, but they feared him on account of his susceptible, excitable, and quarrelsome disposition. As soon as he arrived, he was on a footing of perfect equality with them. He insulted them and beat them. Phenomenally just, it was sufficient for him that there was no injustice to interfere in a matter which did not concern him. He was, moreover, extremely simple. When he quarrelled with the convicts, he reproached them with being thieves, and exhorted them in all sincerity to steal no more. He had served as a sub-lieutenant in the Caucasus. I made friends with him the first day, and he related to me his affair. He had begun as a cadet in a line regiment. After waiting some time for his commission as sub-lieutenant, he at last received it, and was sent into the mountains to command a small fort. Some tributary princeling in the neighbourhood set fire to the fort and made an unsuccessful attack. Akimich was very cunning, and pretended not to know who was the author of the attack, which he attributed to some insurgents wandering about the mountains. A month later, he extended a friendly invitation to the prince to call and see him. The prince, suspecting nothing, arrived on horseback. Akimich drew up the garrison in line of battle and harangued his troops upon the treason and villainy of his visitor. He reproached him with his conduct, proved to him that to set fire to the fort was a shameful crime, explained to him minutely the duties of a tributary prince, and then, by way of peroration to his harangue, had him shot. He at once informed his superior officers of this execution with all the details necessary. Thereupon Akimich was brought to trial. He appeared before a court-martial and was condemned to death, but his sentence was commuted, and he was sent to Siberia as a convict of the second class, condemned, that is to say, to 12 years' hard labour and imprisonment in a fortress. He readily admitted that he had acted illegally, and that the prince ought to have been tried in a civil court and not by a court-martial. Nevertheless, he could not understand that his action was a crime. "He had burned my fort. What was I to do? Was I to thank him for it?" he answered to my objections. Although the convicts laughed at Akimich and pretended that he was a little mad, yet they esteemed him by reason of his cleverness and his precision. He knew all possible trades, and could do whatever you wished. He was cobbler, bootmaker, painter, carver, gilder, and locksmith. He had acquired these talents in prison, for it was sufficient for him to see an object in order to imitate it. He sold in the town, or caused to be sold, baskets, lanterns, and toys. Thanks to his work, he had always some money, which he employed in buying shirts, pillows, and so on. He had made himself a mattress, and as he slept in the same room as myself, he was very useful to me at the beginning of my imprisonment. Before leaving to go to work, the convicts were drawn up in 2 ranks before the orderly room, surrounded by an escort of soldiers with loaded muskets. An officer of engineers then arrived with the superintendent of the works and a few soldiers who watched operations. The superintendent counted the convicts and sent them in parties to their places of work. I went with some other prisoners to the engineer's workshop, a low brick building in the centre of a large courtyard full of materials. There was a forge there, and carpenters, locksmiths, and painters' workshops. Akimich was assigned to the last. He boiled the oil for the varnish, mixed the colours, and painted tables and other pieces of furniture in imitation of walnut. While I was waiting to have additional irons put on, I communicated to him my first impressions. "Yes," he said, "they do not like nobles.
above all those who have been condemned for political offences, and they take a pleasure in wounding their feelings. Surely that is understandable. We do not belong to them. We do not suit them. They have all been serfs or soldiers. Tell me, what sympathy can they have for us? The life here is hard, but it is nothing in comparison with that of the disciplinary companies in Russia. There it is hell. Those who have been in them praise our prison. It is as paradise compared with purgatory. Not that the work is harder. It is said that towards the convicts of the first class, the authorities, who are not exclusively military as here, act quite differently from what they do towards us. They have their little houses, or so I have been told, for I have not seen for myself. They wear no uniform, nor are their heads shaved, though, in my opinion, uniforms and shaved heads are not bad things. All is neater, and also it is more agreeable to the eye, yet these men do not like it. Oh, what a Babel this place is! Soldiers, Circassians, old believers, peasants who have left their wives and families, Jews, gypsies, people come from heaven knows where. And all this variety of men are to live quietly together side by side, eat from the same dish and sleep on the same planks. Not a moment's liberty. No enjoyment except in secret. They must hide their money in their boots, and then there are always the prison walls, perpetual imprisonment. Involuntary wild ideas come to one. As I already knew all this, I was above all anxious to question Akimitch in regard to our governor. He concealed nothing, and the impression which his story left upon me was far from agreeable. I had to live for 2 years under the authority of this officer. All that Akimitch told me about him was strictly true. He was a spiteful, ill-regulated man, terrible above all things, because he possessed almost unlimited power over 200 human beings. He looked upon the prisoners as his personal enemies, his first and a very serious fault. His rare capacity, and perhaps even his good qualities, were perverted by his intemperance and his spitefulness. He sometimes descended like a bombshell upon the barracks in the middle of the night. If he noticed a prisoner asleep on his back or his left side, he awoke him and said, "You must sleep as I ordered." The convicts detested him and feared him like the plague. His repulsive crimson countenance made everyone tremble. We all knew that the governor was entirely in the hands of his servant Fedka, and that he had nearly gone mad when his dog Treasure fell ill. He preferred this dog to every other living creature. When Fedka told him that a certain convict, who had picked up some veterinary knowledge, made wonderful cures, he immediately sent to him and said, "I entrust my dog to your care. If you cure Treasure, I will reward you royally." The man, a very intelligent Siberian peasant, was indeed a good veterinary surgeon, but he was above all a cunning peasant. Long afterwards he used to tell his comrades the story of his visit to the governor. "I looked at Treasure, who lay on a sofa with his head on a white cushion. I saw at once that he had inflammation, and that he wanted bleeding. I think I could have cured him, but I said to myself, 'What will happen if the dog dies? It will be my fault.' 'No, Your Highness,' I said to him, 'you have called me too late. If I had seen your dog yesterday or the day before, he would now be restored to health. But I can do nothing, he will die.' And Treasure died." I was told one day that a convict had tried to assassinate the governor. This prisoner had for several years been noted for his submissive attitude and for his silence. He was even regarded as a madman. As he was not altogether illiterate, he spent his nights reading the Bible. When everyone was asleep, he rose, climbed up onto the stove, lit a church taper, opened his gospel, and began to read. He did this for a whole year. One fine day, however, he left the ranks and declared that he would not go to work. He was reported to the governor, who flew into a rage and hurried to the barracks. The convict rushed forward, hurled a brick at him, which he had procured beforehand, and missed. He was seized, tried, and whipped,
It was a matter of a few moments, and was carried to the hospital, where he died 3 days later. He declared during his last moments that he hated no one, and that, although he had wished to suffer, he belonged to no sect of fanatics. Afterwards, whenever his name was mentioned in the barracks, it was always with respect. At last they put new irons on me. While they were being soldered, a number of young women selling little white loaves came into the forge one after another. They were, for the most part, quite little girls who came to sell the loaves that their mothers had baked. As they got older, they still continued to hang about us, but they no longer brought bread. They were always, some of them, about together with a number of married women. Each roll cost 2 kopecks, and nearly all the prisoners bought them. I noticed one convict who worked as a carpenter. He was already growing grey, but had a ruddy, smiling complexion. He was joking with the vendors of rolls. Before they arrived, he had tied a red handkerchief round his neck. A fat woman, much marked with the smallpox, put down her basket on the carpenter's table, and they began to talk.
"Why didn't you come yesterday?"
asked the convict, with a self-satisfied smile.
"I did come, but you had gone," replied the woman boldly. "Yes, they marched us off, otherwise we should have met. The day before yesterday they all came to see me."
"Who did?"
"Why, Mariashka, Havroshka, Chekunda, Dugrochva."
This last woman charged 4 kopecks.
"What?" I said to Akimitch. "Is it possible that?"
"Yes, it happens sometimes," he replied, lowering his eyes, for he was a very proper man. "Yes, it happened sometimes, but rarely, and with unheard-of difficulties. The convicts preferred to spend their money on drink. It was very difficult to meet these women. One had to agree on place and time, arrange a meeting, find solitude, and, most difficult of all, avoid the escort, almost an impossibility, and spend relatively prodigious sums. I have sometimes, however, witnessed love scenes. One day, 3 of us were heating a brick kiln on the banks of the Irtych. The soldiers of the escort were good-natured fellows. 2 blowers, as they were called, soon appeared.
"What kept you so long?" asked one fellow, who had evidently been expecting them. "Was it at the Zvierkovs that you were detained?"
"At the Zvierkovs? It will be fine weather and the fowls will have teeth when I go to see them," replied one of the women. She was the dirtiest woman imaginable. She was called Chekunda, and had arrived in company with her friend, she of the 4 kopecks, who was beyond all description.
"It's a long time since we saw anything of you," says the gallant to Miss 4 kopecks. "You seem to have grown thinner."
"Perhaps. I was once good-looking and plump, but now you might fancy I had swallowed eels."
"And you still run after the soldiers, eh?"
"That's all wicked gossip. In any case, if I was to be flogged to death for it, I like soldiers."
"Never mind your soldiers. We're the people to love. We have money."
Imagine this gallant with his shaved crown, with fetters on his ankles, dressed in a coat of 2 colours, and watched by an escort. My irons had now been fixed, and I had to return to the prison. I wished Akimitch goodbye and moved off, escorted by a soldier. Those who do task work return first, and when I got back to the barracks, a good number of convicts were already there. As the kitchen could not have held the whole barrack full at once, we did not all dine together. Those who came in first were first served. I tasted the cabbage soup, but, not being used to it, could not eat it, so I prepared myself some tea. I sat down at one end of the table with a convict of noble birth like myself. The prisoners were going in and out, but there was no want of room, for there were not many of them. 5 men sat down apart from the large table. The cook gave each of them 2 ladles full of soup, and brought them a plate of fried fish. These men were having a holiday. They looked at us in a friendly manner. One of the Poles came in and took his seat by our side.
"I was not with you, but I know that you are having a feast," exclaimed a tall convict who now came in. He was a man of about 50 years, thin and muscular. His face indicated cunning and at the same time liveliness. His lower lip, fleshy and pendant, gave him a soft expression.
"Well, have you slept well? Why don't you say how do you do?"
"Well now, my friend of Kursk," he said, sitting down by the side of the diners. "Good appetite? Here's a new guest for you."
"We are not from the province of Kursk."
"Then my friends from Tambov, shall we say?" "We are not from Tambov, either. You've no claim on us. If you want to enjoy yourself, go to some rich peasant."
"I have Maria Ikotishna in my belly, otherwise I should die of hunger. But where is your peasant to be found?"
Ikotishna comes from the word ikot and means hiccup.
"Good heavens! We mean Gazin. Go to him. Gazin is on the drink today. He's devouring his capital."
"He has at least 20 rubles, says another convict. "It's profitable keeping a drinking shop."
"You won't have me? Then I must eat government food."
"Will you have some tea? If so, ask these noblemen for some."
"What noblemen? They're no longer noblemen. They're no better than us," droned a convict who was seated in the corner and had not yet ventured a word.
"I should like a cup of tea, but I'm ashamed to ask for it. I have self-respect," said the fellow with a heavy lip, looking at me with a good-humoured air.
"I'll give you some if you like," I said.
"Will you have some?"
"What do you mean, will I have some? Who wouldn't have some?" he said, coming towards the table.
"Only think. When he was free, he ate nothing but cabbage soup and black bread. But now he's in prison, he must have tea like a perfect gentleman," continued the convict with the sombre air.
"Does no one here drink tea?" I asked him. But he did not think me worthy of a reply.
"White rolls! White rolls! Who'll buy?"
A young prisoner was carrying in a netload of kolachi, scones, which he proposed to sell in the prison. For every 10 that he sold, the baker gave him one for his trouble. It was precisely on this 10th scone that he counted for his dinner.
"White rolls! White rolls!" he cried as he entered the kitchen. "White Moscow rolls, all hot! I'd eat the lot of them, but I want money, lots of money! Come on, lads! There's only one apiece for every mother's son."
This appeal to filial love made everyone laugh, and several of his white rolls were purchased.
"Well," he said, "Gazin has drunk in such a style it's downright sinful. He's chosen the right moment, too. If the man with 8 eyes should arrive, we shall hide him."
"Is he very drunk?"
"Yes, and ill-tempered, too, unmanageable. There'll be some fighting, then."
"Of whom are they speaking?" I asked the Pole who sat next to me.
"Of Gazin. He is a prisoner who sells spirits. When he has gained a little money by his trade, he drinks it to the last kopeck. A cruel, malicious brute when he has been drinking. When sober, he is quiet enough. But when he is in drink, he shows himself in his true character. He attacks people with a knife until it is taken from him."
"How do they manage that?"
10 men throw themselves upon him and beat him like a sack without mercy until he loses consciousness. When he is half dead with the beating, they lay him down on his plank bedstead and cover him over with his pelisse.
But they might kill him. Anyone else would die of it, but not he. He is excessively robust. He is the strongest of all the convicts. His constitution is so hard that the day after one of these punishments he gets up perfectly sound.
Tell me, please," I continued, still addressing the Pole, "why these people keep their food to themselves, and at the same time seem to envy me my tea?"
"Your tea has nothing to do with it. They are envious of you. Are you not a gentleman? You in no way resemble them. They would be glad to pick a quarrel with you in order to humiliate you. You don't know what you will have to put up with. It is martyrdom for men like us to be here. Our life is doubly painful, and great strength of character alone can accustom us to it. You will be vexed and tormented in all sorts of ways on account of your food and your tea, although quite a number of men buy their own food and drink tea daily. They have a right to do so. You have not."
A few minutes later, he rose and left the table. His predictions were very soon fulfilled.